Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
From global current affairs to art, science and culture, the documentary from the BBC World Service tells the world's stories. Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 27th of September, these are our main stories. A judge in New York has ruled that Donald Trump committed fraud for years by repeatedly exaggerating his wealth. The Speaker of Canada's Parliament has stepped down after he unwittingly praised a Ukrainian man who fought for the Nazis during the Second World War. And an Israeli minister has become the first member of Israel's cabinet to make a public visit to Saudi Arabia. Also in this podcast.
It hurts a lot. You'll read a lot where it says it feels like an elastic band flicking against your skin, and it absolutely does not. It feels like when you're frying an egg and you get that spatter coming back.
Ouch. We hear about the growing market for tattoo removal. We begin in the United States, where a judge in New York has ruled that the former US President Donald Trump committed financial fraud when he was building his property empire. The judge, Arthur Engoron, said Mr. Trump exaggerated his wealth by over $2 billion. I spoke to the BBC's Peter Bowes in the US and asked him what else the judge had said.
This is a very serious case for the president. And just to give you a little bit of the background, it's part of a long-term investigation into the Trump Organization and Donald Trump's business affairs in New York, a case brought by New York's Attorney General Letitia James. It's a civil lawsuit. That lawsuit continues, or at least continues in a courtroom as of next week. But what the judge has decided in this summary judgment, which simply means that the judge believes that there is indisputable evidence for him to make a ruling outside of the framework of a trial inside a courtroom. So the judge has essentially agreed with the allegations brought by the Attorney General that Mr. Trump, in his business world, as part of his property empire, had been committing fraud over a number of years. He found that Mr. Trump and his company deceived banks, insurers, others by massively overvaluing his assets, exaggerating his net worth. This is on the paperwork that he used in various deals. And significant that the judge believes that this goes further than just bragging about his riches. He said this company, the Trump Organization, repeatedly lied about their financial affairs. And he said, the judge said, that these were tactics that crossed a line and violated the law.
So, Peter, what are the implications of this, both now and when it comes to trial? Presumably a jury will then decide.
Yeah, well, interestingly, this is a non-jury trial. Right. So this is going to be in the presence of a judge, but maybe that's a small detail. But the implications right now from the ruling that we've just heard, some of the Trump Organization's business licenses have been rescinded already. And that's an immediate effect. That will limit the organization's ability to do business in New York. When we get to the case, and there are other issues still outstanding, in effect, what the judge's ruling does is make it somewhat easier for the Attorney General to prove her case, because part of it has been taken off the table. But ultimately, she is seeking $250 million in penalties against the company and a ban on Donald Trump doing business in New York. This is a case that could last for several weeks, and we obviously won't know the implications until it reaches its conclusion.
Peter Bowes. And Mr. Trump had denied wrongdoing. Meanwhile, President Biden has joined a picket line in Detroit, urging car workers to stick with their strike there. He made a brief speech at a factory on the 12th day of major industrial action against America's biggest car makers. Mr. Biden is the first sitting US president to join a picket line. He told the strikers they deserved a big pay rise and that it was time for manufacturers to step up.
You guys, UAW, you saved the automobile industry back in 2008 and before. Made a lot of sacrifices, gave up a lot, and the companies were in trouble. But now they're doing incredibly well. And guess what? You should be doing incredibly well, too. You deserve the significant raise you need and other benefits.
Let's get it!
Bring it back who we lost, okay?
Yeah.
them, it's about time they have a step up for us. Thank you.
Donald Trump is also expected to travel to Michigan on Wednesday to show his support for the workers. The blue-collar vote in so-called Rust Belt states is key to both men's presidential election campaigns. Our US correspondent Gary O'Donoghue told me more about the car workers' strike.
Well, it's a pretty significant strike. It's the first time the union, this big UAW auto workers' union, has gone out against all the major manufacturers at one time. And it's really about a number of things, partly about pay and conditions, but also about the sort of changing nature of the industry. And the problem for Joe Biden here is that his green agenda in some ways is coming up against the union's agenda, because he wants more electric vehicles, etc. That means battery plants where there are less union representation and there tend to be lower wages. So this is the sort of constituency he needs to prop up. Those auto workers and other blue collar workers in places like Michigan, where he is today, are absolutely crucial to his re-election. This is the Rust Belt of America, and this is what gets a Democratic presidential candidates re-elected.
And they're crucial too for Donald Trump, should he become the Republican Party nominee. What is he going to be saying when he visits the same place, different crowd?
Donald Trump has successfully, certainly in 2016, persuaded these parts of the Rust Belt that he was on their side. Now, of course, when he was in the White House, he prioritised tax cuts for the richer part of the country. In many ways, the jobs started to leak away to Mexico and places like that from these sorts of plants. But he's gone on the front foot again today. He said, Joe Biden is letting your jobs go. I will save your jobs. He says, I will make you rich, was his promise to the auto workers. So the old rhetoric is back.
And significant that Donald Trump will be addressing non-unionised workers.
I think that's to ensure a kind of welcome he wants. His message will be to the wider blue-collar constituency in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, those sorts of places. But he needs to make sure that the optics are right at the time.
Gary O'Donoghue. The US government has launched a lawsuit against the retail giant Amazon, accusing it of stifling competition across a huge portion of the online economy. The Federal Trade Commission and 17 American states say that Amazon's actions allow it to prevent rivals from lowering prices, degrade quality for shoppers, and stifle innovation. From New York, here's Erin Delmore.
The U.S.'s competition regulator, the Federal Trade Commission, has been building its case against Amazon for years. It alleges that Amazon biases its search results, favoring its own products over better quality alternatives. Also, that it forces sellers to offer their lowest prices on Amazon by placing them lower in search results if they don't. The government also claims that Amazon requires sellers to use its network of delivery services or risk being left out of its paid-for Prime program. In a statement, Amazon's general counsel rejected the accusations, saying the company's practices increased competition, innovation, and selection, and resulted in lower prices and faster delivery for customers.
Erin Delmore. In Canada, the Speaker of the country's parliament, Anthony Rota, has resigned days after a former Nazi soldier was honoured there as a Canadian hero. Jaroslav Hunka, a 98-year-old Ukrainian, was given a standing ovation in the chamber during a visit by President Zelensky. Mr. Rota has apologised and said he regretted his mistake. Grant Ferret reports.
An event which was intended to bolster support for Ukraine and highlight the strength of bonds with Canada has turned into a political and diplomatic fiasco. President Zelensky and the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, joined the ovation for Jaroslav Hunka in the parliamentary chamber in Ottawa. Mr. Rota said he'd fought for Ukrainian independence from the Soviet Union and was a Ukrainian and Canadian hero. It quickly became clear that Mr. Hunka had been a volunteer with a Nazi unit. The Speaker initially resisted pressure to step down, but has now announced his resignation. He said he alone was responsible for inviting Mr. Hunka. A Jewish organisation in Canada is among those to have accused the Speaker of handing a propaganda victory to Russia.
Grant Ferret. There were public signs on Tuesday of move towards establishing formal diplomatic relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel, an idea that was unthinkable until a few years ago. For the first time, a member of the Israeli cabinet, the tourism minister Chaim Katz, has travelled to Saudi Arabia. At the same time, though, Saudi Arabia's first non-resident ambassador to the occupied West Bank, on a visit there, has pledged that the Palestinian cause will be a cornerstone of any normalisation deal with his country. Our Middle East correspondent Tom Bateman gave us his analysis.
Well, what we've seen is a day of firsts in the evolving public diplomacy of the Middle East. And you mentioned Chaim Katz, who in the last few hours it has emerged, has visited Riyadh. He's in Riyadh. He's going to spend 2 days at this United Nations tourism conference. But the point is, this is the first public and official visit by an Israeli cabinet minister to Saudi Arabia. So that is significant. And at the same time, and I think the timing is not unintentional about these two things, we've had the first visit by Saudi Arabia's newly appointed non-resident ambassador to the Palestinians. Now, he's been in the occupied West Bank, in Ramallah, in the seat of government of the Palestinian Authority. But this is the first such visit by a Saudi official in at least 3 decades. And what is going on in the background here is that American-driven process to try and forge normalization of relations. It would be a historic realignment of diplomatic ties in the Middle East between two old adversaries. But it would effectively be a three-way deal because the US would have to underwrite this. And it would also, very controversially, mean the US giving security guarantees to Saudi Arabia. And one of the things that we understand is in that shopping list from the Saudis is they want very advanced American weapons. They also want, very controversially, the ability to enrich uranium for a civilian nuclear power program in Saudi Arabia. All of that is the quid pro quo for them normalizing ties with the Israelis. Now, these things are a very long way off. I think it's going to be at least months. But we've heard increasing signals, not least from the leaders of all three countries, that this process is continuing.
Our Middle East correspondent, Tom Bateman. Now, have you ever done something you bitterly regret? Well, it seems many people have, because one market is growing: tattoo removal. The BBC's Elizabeth Hodson has been finding out.
On the sunny south coast of England, Brighton hosts one of the UK's biggest body art conventions. And above the hum of the tattooist needles at this year's event, I chatted to one of Slovenia's top artists, Simona Borsner from Tauchi Tattoo. She says people sometimes regret their tattoos because they followed trends which, like clothes, come and go.
I started tattooing 10 years ago, and then it was really, really popular to get an infinity sign and the like bird silhouettes flying out of it, and also a lot of letterings. And now, after 10 years, people cover that up because it was a trend then, and now it's not trendy anymore. So I guess what I would recommend is just to get something that you really like, not something that, I don't know, some famous person has.
But not everyone puts that much thought into it, and getting a tattoo lasered off is an option. And as the procedures become more popular, the technology has also got better, says Dr. Dennis Das, a Beverly Hills plastic surgeon and tattoo removal specialist.
The newer technology is a picosecond ND YAG or Alexandrite laser. The newer technology delivers the energy in a much smaller time frame. There's a lot more energy delivered to the tattoo so that we can destroy the tattoo more effectively.
It's easier to get a tattoo removed, but it's still not cheap. Removery is the world's biggest laser tattoo removal specialist, and Joe Kelton is chief operating officer. Using my own 8-centimetre long full-colour hummingbird as an example, I asked how much it would cost to remove.
For your tattoo, it would be around $2,500, and that would be around 2 years to remove.
So, if you've got the cash, what's the experience actually like? This is Kirk Diglis-Take. He's a tattoo removal specialist I chatted to at the tattoo convention.
It hurts a lot. I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, I would say the pain level's probably a good 7 or 8. It's up there.
What's the sensation like? Because you've got some tattoos yourself. Have you ever had one lasered off?
Yeah, I've lasered myself many times. And I'm going to be perfectly honest with you guys. You'll read a lot what it says. It feels like an elastic band flicking against your skin, and it absolutely does not. It feels like when you're frying an egg and you get that spatter coming back.
Not everyone who wants a tattoo removed regrets getting a massive back piece or someone's name. Part of the industry specialises in medical tattooing. Back in 2021, Tanya Buxton founded the Mastectomy Tattooing Alliance, which raises funds to pay for people to have mastectomy and areola tattoos. and a corner of medical tattooing also deals with removal.
If you have radiotherapy as part of your breast cancer treatment, they tattoo in tiny little dots. It's like their markers, their radiation markers. Obviously, that's done at the hospital, so they're quite significant dots that look a bit bluey, like they're not very attractive dots to have. Many people find it's a permanent reminder, and a lot of people don't really want those radiation dots there anymore. You can kind of tattoo that saline solution in to draw that radiation dot tattoo out. And you can also tattoo in like a colour corrective pigment colour to neutralise the radiation dot colour and make it look like it's like a freckle kind of thing. It's really clever what you can do.
People's reasons for having a tattoo removed are massively varied, but whatever the rationale, it definitely pays to do your research.
Elizabeth Hodson reporting there. Still to come.
Unlike sharks that never stop growing new sets of teeth, humans only get two sets.
But what if we could grow new teeth? Hope may be breaking through in Japan.
Suddenly my quilt is ripped off me and then my room is full of white men. And I thought, I'm done for. These are fascists. They found where I live.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe.
Betrayal. It runs through my life and runs through my story.
I was just all alone in this vast, broken system.
I never gave up my dream.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Next to Nagorno-Karabakh, as we heard in the earlier podcast, a top US aid official has called for international access to the region, describing the testimonies of ethnic Armenians fleeing the disputed territory as harrowing. Samantha Power promised nearly $12 million in support for them. Armenia says it's now received nearly 30,000 refugees from Karabakh who left fearing that Azerbaijan might start ethnic cleansing. Armenia and Azerbaijan have discussed the situation at EU-backed talks. I spoke to the BBC's Kazra Naji, who's been seeing the refugees arrive in Armenia.
I am at this village called Kornizur, which is the first village. The refugees from Karabakh, when they come to Armenia, they arrive at this village. And in front of me, there's a long stream of cars with the lights on. It's dark here now, but you can see it for a mile. I can see from where I'm standing. So they're still coming, big numbers. I've been talking to quite a few of them, in fact. They are dazed, they are confused, they are angry, they are tired, and they don't know what is going to happen next. Many of them I talked to didn't know where they were going. A lot of them don't think they will ever go back to their homes.
What are people saying to you about the conditions in Nagorno-Karabakh that has meant they've had to flee?
A lot of shooting, a lot of insecurity, a lot of explosions around them, and all the reports of Azerbaijanis around them made them pretty fearful. And a lot of them decided to leave because of that. When I asked them whether they believed Azerbaijanis, when Azerbaijanis say that they will guarantee their security, nobody said they will believe the Azerbaijanis. Don't forget, the two sides have fought several wars in the past four decades, and there is no trust at all between the two sides.
And Kazra, to what extent is there concern within Armenia itself that what's happened in Nagorno-Karabakh may well not be the end of it?
Oh, there is quite a lot of concern on that front because there are fears that Azerbaijan, with the backing of Turkey, has territorial ambitions in Armenia. And that is why people are particularly concerned. Nikol Pashinyan, the prime minister, was talking about this, blaming Russia for what is happening in the last week or so, because Russian forces, there were 20,000 of them, were peacekeepers here, were supposed to keep peace, but they looked the other way while the Azerbaijanis took over the land in Karabakh.
Kazra Naji in Armenia. The British Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, has told a right-wing think tank in Washington that the United Nations Refugee Convention, which was drawn up after the Second World War, is no longer fit for the modern age. She argued that uncontrolled and irregular migration was an existential threat to the West, and that fearing discrimination for being gay or being a woman should not be enough to qualify for refugee protection.
There is an optimal level of immigration. It is not zero. There has been more migration to the UK and Europe in the last 25 years than in all the time that went before. It has been too much, too quick, with too little thought given to integration and the impact on social cohesion. If cultural change is too rapid and too big, then what was already there is diluted. Unless countries can prevent or rapidly remove illegal migrants, pressures on the state will compound over time.
But the UK director of the Human Rights Watch group, Yasmin Ahmed, says it is more important than ever to support refugees and those who offer them protection.
The debate should be one rather than about how do we stop people from seeking protection? How do we dilute our human rights protections and the international conventions? What we are saying very clearly is the debate should be about how do we do global responsibility sharing? How do we provide safe routes? How do we support the countries that host the most refugees and asylum seekers, which are neighbouring countries? Once we undermine and unstrip the international system, it means that we can no longer be saying to Russia that you shouldn't be occupying Ukraine. We can no longer say to China that you should not be exerting any aggression in relation to Taiwan. There are many, many and extreme consequences of the UK unpicking and undermining the international rules-based order.
Well, the UK helped to shape the United Nations Refugee Convention in the 1950s. So what's the core of Ms. Braverman's argument against it now? I spoke to our political correspondent, Rob Watson.
At the core of her argument is just that there are levels of legal immigration are too high, but that also you're seeing such large movements of people. She says maybe the argument should go that you would tighten the definition of who constitutes a refugee, and her point being that her argument being that perhaps you should make it clear there's a difference between persecution, that would definitely entitle you to refugee status, but possibly not discrimination. Say, for example, she argued whether you were gay or whether you were a woman. And of course, as you were hinting at there, Nick, what's really kind of striking about how the modern Conservative Party has moved so much to the populist right, it's worth remembering that back in the 1950s, when this was being debated, it was Britain that was moving for a sort of a wider and more universal definition of who would be a refugee.
And Rob, this speech was made in Washington, but it was mainly intended for a domestic audience, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the first important thing to say, Nick, is that Suella Braverman believes this. I mean, she is someone very much on the right of the modern Conservative Party, very much on the right of European politics. You heard a clear line on immigration, that there's been too much of it in Europe, that multiculturalism had failed, as she put it. But look, I think it would be naive not to think this was directed at a domestic audience, and no out, having in mind that the Conservatives, the governing Conservative Party, are a long way behind in the polls. They're not seen to have had a good record after 13 years of office. The thought being that maybe Suella Braverman and others in the Conservative Party will use these kind of values issues, these culture war issues, in order to perhaps chip away at the opposition Labour Party's lead ahead of the expected general election next year.
And Rob, there's no doubt it will be popular, this redefinition of what is a refugee amongst certain members of British society.
Yes, absolutely. It'll certainly be popular in the governing Conservative Party amongst its activists and MPs, but the opinion polling does consistently suggest that there is concern amongst British voters, primarily Conservative voters, about the levels of immigration in this country and asylum, legal and illegal.
Rob Watson. Well, the UN Refugee Agency has defended its Convention on Refugees after the comments made by Suella Braverman. As we just heard, she had suggested it was absurd and unsustainable and called for its reform. It said the convention had saved millions of lives. Imogen Folkes reports from Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency rejected the suggestion the Convention on Refugees, first drafted in 1951, needs reform. The agency also questioned Suella Braverman's distinction between persecution and discrimination in relation to women or gay people, saying it was crucial those at risk because of their gender or sexual orientation could seek protection. A better response to increased arrivals and the asylum backlog, the agency said, would be faster decisions on asylum and safe legal routes for refugees.
Imogen, folks. Here in London, five people have appeared in court accused of being part of a Russian spy ring operating from a hotel in Norfolk in eastern England. The Bulgarian nationals allegedly conspired to gather information on behalf of the Kremlin between 2020 and February of this year. Daniel de Simone followed proceedings at Westminster Magistrates Court.
The five Bulgarian nationals, three men and two women, have lived in Britain for years. Some had apparently normal jobs, including a beautician and laboratory assistant. But they're accused of secretly working as spies, carrying out surveillance on places and people targeted by Russia, to apparently assist Moscow in carrying out hostile actions, including potential abductions. The alleged cell is said to have been run from the UK, with members operating both here and in Europe. One of the alleged spies, Ivan Stoyanov, is a one-time mixed martial arts fighter known as the Destroyer.
Your winner by KO, Ivan the Destroyer Stoyanov!
It's alleged the spy cell's operations hub was a now-closed seaside guesthouse in Great Yarmouth, occupied by one of the accused, Orlin Rusev, who's said to have been directed from abroad by a man known as Jan Marsalek. He's not charged and is wanted in Germany in a major fraud case. He's now believed to be in Russia. The five defendants appeared in court by video link. They've yet to enter pleas and were remanded in custody to appear at the Old Bailey next month.
Daniel de Simone. The International Criminal Police Organisation, Interpol, has issued a red notice for the arrest of the fugitive Venezuelan gang leader, Hector Guerrero Flores, who escaped last week from a prison where he'd lived a life of luxury. He fled before the arrival last Wednesday of 11,000 soldiers and police who regained control of the compound. Our Latin America editor, Vanessa Bushlukta, told us more about the wanted man, Hector Guerrero Flores, known as the Boy Guerrero.
He is the leader of a criminal enterprise called Tren de Aragua. Tren de Aragua is a Venezuelan-based criminal gang which started by extorting locals and then extorting migrants, the many thousands and hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans who've been leaving the country. And then, of course, as those migrants left Venezuela, the Tren de Aragua also established itself in the countries where these migrants went to. So they've been seen in Peru, in Chile, in Ecuador, Colombia, Venezuela, of course, and Brazil.
Now, the leader, Hector Guerrero Flores, who's now a free man at the moment, somewhere, we don't know where, had been in prison. It wasn't any old prison, though, was it? He pretty much ruled the roost.
That's right. So he had been in and out of Tocoron prison in Aragua State in Venezuela since 2010. And he constructed parts of this prison into almost a luxury resort. There was a swimming pool. There was a makeshift bank. There was a betting shop, a restaurant, a baseball diamond. There was even a petting zoo, because a lot of the inmates' families actually moved into the prison because life there was more pleasant than life on the outside. So during Venezuela's economic crisis, there would be locals queuing to get into the prison to get the basics from the inmates who sourced them from further afield.
And this was widely known. The authorities didn't seem to do much about it. It begs the question, why, if it was so luxurious, why would he want to leave in the first place if he could carry on running his empire from there?
Exactly. Well, what some of the experts who know the inside of this prison have said is the reason why he stayed in there for so long, because he was able to come and go as he wanted. He was once seen by police on a yacht during a luxurious carnival party, and he actually showed them a safe passage that he'd been given by the prison authorities that allowed him to come and go. The reason why he now escaped is that it seems like President Maduro of Venezuela came under increased pressure from presidents in the region, like in Chile, to do something about the Tren de Aragua, this gang that he led. And so he decided to conduct a massive raid. He sent 11,000 soldiers and police into the prison to clear it and to regain control of this penitentiary. And our man, Nino Guerrero, as he's known, he was tipped off to this. So he left just before.
Vanessa Bushlukta there. Now, in some countries, the tooth fairy, or equivalent, rewards children for losing their baby teeth with money left under the pillow. After that, if you happen to lose your adult teeth, there is no reward, of course, and it is a lot harder to fix. But imagine if you could simply grow new teeth. It would be a world first if it makes it through human clinical trials, but there is hope in Japan. Phoebe Hobson reports.
Unlike sharks that never stop growing new sets of teeth, humans only get two sets. And if you damage your second adult set, you don't really have many other options than perhaps a toothless smile or paying for expensive dentures or implants. But scientists at a pharmaceutical startup in Kyoto, Japan, have announced they plan to start human clinical trials for a drug that could help you maybe grow some new incisors, canines and molars. They hope it will work by stimulating dormant tooth buds that disappear once we have our full adult set. But don't stop brushing just yet, as the trials won't start until next year, and then it could take several years for the drug to reach the market. If it does, it will be the first of its kind. Dr. Katsu Takahashi, who is working on the study, told local media that the idea of growing new teeth is every dentist's dream. The team has already had some success growing new teeth in ferrets, which have both baby and permanent teeth similar to humans.
Phoebe Hobson. The world of mountain climbing is in a dilemma at the moment. The legendary mountaineer Reinhold Messner has been stripped of two world records after a researcher sitting at a desk using maps and satellite pictures declared that Messner had in fact missed the summit of Annapurna 1 in the Himalayas by a few metres. It is apparently easily done. The researcher has never visited the Himalayas but did enough to persuade Guinness World Records that Messner messed up. The record for the first ascent of the world's 14 highest peaks has now been awarded to an American, Ed Vestis. So, it does seem odd that 38 years after the actual climber, an amateur cartographer a continent away, can act as referee. Messler himself says it's nonsense. Evan Davis spoke to the mountaineer Alan Arnett. He's climbed Mount Everest and in 2014 became the oldest American to summit K2, the world's second highest peak. So does he think that Messler has been hard done by when his record has been taken away from him?
I think the overall situation doesn't really have a lot of point to it. If you talk to most people who climb mountains, and I think Messner has said this himself, that he doesn't climb to make records, to set records. He climbs for the personal challenge. And I think that's how most people in the mountaineering community feel about climbing. However, there are exceptions in the last, I guess, handful of years with people seeking headlines and documentaries and all sorts of self-promotion by way of setting records.
What is most interesting about this, though, is the idea that you can accidentally not make the peak. Now, Just tell me, Adam, how easy is it to go up all that way and just get the wrong little bit poking up?
It's a really good question. You would think that you would climb until there's no place to go ever higher. And by definition, now you're at the tallest point of that mountain. But a lot of factors come into it. There's false summits where you have undulating ridgeline. The one that was really in question for Mr. Messner was Annapurna. It has 8 unique summits on it. And it's kind of a ridge that goes up and down, up and down. And, if it's really cloudy or if you're in a blizzard in a whiteout condition, it's quite plausible that you think that you're at the very top, but you're not. I think that there's really 2 buckets here. There are people that make an honest mistake, and then there are people that knowingly don't make the summit, and then they come back and claim they did. And that's fraud, and I think that's where the root of all this comes
from. But no one is suggesting Messner did that. Messner didn't. And he didn't, presumably. Now, don't you have little devices to tell you whether you've hit the peak or do you just have to rely on your eyes?
Exactly. We have GPS devices today, satellite photography. We have high resolution maps that you can look on Google Earth on the internet and figure out where the true summit is. But back in the 70s when he was doing this, none of that technology was available. So really, it was up to the individual climber to make that determination.
Have you ever messed up, ever climbed a mountain and come back and summited? Actually, you made the wrong bit there. No, the real peak's over there.
I have not, but comparing someone like me to Reinhold Messner is truly apples and airplanes. I climb with Sherpas. And in fact, my own story in this realm happened on Manaslu, another 8,000-meter mountain. I got to what I was told was the true summit, in 2013, and I was told by the Sherpas who fixed the ropes, and this particular Sherpa had 20 summits of Everest, so I trusted him implicitly, only to find out years later that, in fact, we had missed the true summit, and it was revealed by a drone footage taken a couple of years ago that we had reached the fore summit, not the true summit.
The mountaineer Alan Arnett. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Leah McSheffrey. The editor, Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.